Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Now it's time for our Friday gathering, and this week I'm joined by Fianna Fáil MEP Barry Andrews, Sinn Féin MEP Lynn Boylan, political editor with the Journal.ie Christina Finn, and Gerard Howland, who's a columnist and public affairs consultant. And you're all welcome. Thank you for coming in today. Charlie Weston was on with us a little bit earlier with this new report from Eurostat, which tells us that Ireland is the second most expensive country in the EU for goods and services. Gerard, you're writing about the economy today. Now, from a slightly different point of view, because you're talking about infrastructure and how you say the government hasn't been able to grapple with those big issues. But do you lay some of the blame for these consumer prices that we're paying at the government's door too?
Probably less so, to be fair. A lot of consumer price increases are imported. If you look at the prices of commodities globally, wheat, which feeds into food and all the rest, all those commodity prices are up and way up, have been over a long time. The amount of competitive issues that are in our control, in our country, in terms of the bag of groceries we buy, are much less so than, for example, the services we use, such as legal, accountancy, or indeed infrastructure.
So are you saying that countries around the world, particularly in Europe, because we can compare ourselves, the prices have gone up there too. But that doesn't explain why we're at the top of the table.
No, and there's a differential between, I think, the groceries and the food at one end, of which there's less responsibility inside the country to other issues, for example, in relation to restaurant hotels, we're at the second highest, and in relation to non-alcoholic drink as well, we're very high. And some of these issues are about wages. Wages have risen sharply here. The reason for that, public sector pay is rising very generously. But of course, people's costs are rising. Rent, the bag of groceries. So it's a cycle. And one is pushing up the other. There has been some missteps by the government that have been particularly inflationary. I think particularly in relation to housing, have made houses more expensive. Subsidies for people getting on the housing ladder are counterproductive in the end. So it is a mixed bag. There are some things the government should do better in relation to some of these issues. Some of it, as I say, are imported prices that are globally, including energy. But if you look at solutions, if we landed our wind energy, if we brought it ashore, if we were further ahead in that, that would have a big impact on energy prices and security long term. Mm-hmm. If we did what the Troika was about to do before it left and took its sledgehammer to the legal profession and practices there, and that agenda had actually been implemented, that would be a counter-inflationary issue. And it could go on and on, particularly in relation to professional services.
Right. Christina, what hope do you have the prices are going to come down?
Not much hope, just because I think there is a feeling sometimes, I think, that government sometimes takes a bit of a hands-off approach when it comes to talking about some of the things like food prices and energy prices.
They did bring the supermarkets in, didn't they? And they said, please, can you bring the prices down?
Yeah, this is the thing when there's inflationary prices or people, it hits the headlines and people are saying it's costing too much to go and get my weekly shop. Oftentimes the minister gets everyone together, says he's going to have a big meeting. It kind of implied that it's going to be tough talking, but really at the end of the day, it's probably tea and biscuits and please try and bring the prices down. There's little they think they can do about it. Like, there are things in the programme for government, particularly around the energy companies, about setting up some sort of review about how that whole system operates here. We are kind of, our hands are kind of tied in terms of the pricing of energy. It's kind of dealt with at a European level. I think the minister was there over in Luxembourg at the Energy Council this week, and they were talking about how you might reset the price, how the whole system is done and how we link our prices to the gas price, which in turn just kind of escalates things, and that's why we pay high prices. But that's, you know, that's years away if you're talking about
EU
change.
Wind energy, you know.
But more years away than it should be.
Now, the other way to deal with this in the short term is the energy credit. And the government was so quick, Barry, to say no energy credit this time out in this budget. And, I mean, here we are now, even in the last week, when this action, Israeli action started against her, prices are going way up. Do you still think the government should hold that line on energy credits?
Sorry, just first of all, I mean, the oil prices have not dramatically gone up. I mean, that's the expectation.
The expectation
that they might,
is that they will.
That they might, yeah. But it hasn't happened. Normally it happens very quickly. Mm. Certainly that's what happened in the Ukraine
but
war.
Even apart from that, accept that people are squeezed because all prices are going up,
yeah, I do.
Help in the form of an energy credit would certainly be welcome and needed.
We're not going to decide the budget here, but at the National Dialogue, the Taoiseach spoke to the to those that are in attendance. And he said, we are doing everything we can to target specific measures to try to address the cost of living mm-hmm. issue. So,
but,
for example...
But they've all been really clear, and you'll know this, energy credit is gone. Not happening.
Well that may be the case. That may be the case. We'll see what's going to happen. There's more than one party in the government. So all of this will be negotiated in the next while. Could I also just say that it is important to balance out these reports about Ireland is the most expensive place. Dublin is the fifth most expensive city in Europe. The report that came out during the week pointed out that when you balance that against average monthly salary in Ireland, in other words, it's very, you know, low prices in Romania, but so are salaries very low in Romania. So Ireland has high prices, but it has very high mm-hmm. average monthly salaries. And
well,
the report,
don't leave out the other part of that, which is we don't get the public services exactly. that other countries get.
Wait a minute. So this particular report points out that Dublin is 13 out of 37 in terms of affordability of Dublin cities.
What report are you talking about? You're not talking about the Eurostat report.
It was in the Irish Times.
That's not the Eurostat report. That was the other report.
Okay. But there is a report which says as follows.
There's a report to prove any point that you would like to prove.
I think the one we're talking about today is that we're the second most expensive.
Yes, but we have to balance it against average monthly.
But
look at what
salaries.
The Danes get. Do you know what I mean? For being the most expensive, they get childcare, they get public health services. Do you know what I mean? They have good transport services. So they actually, do you know what I mean? While living in an expensive country, they have very good value public services, if not free public services. So in Ireland, we have, very, very high costs, things that some of it is in the control of the government, some of it isn't, it's external. But they're also then, not getting the public services either for their taxes.
Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is this other report balanced the mere prices with average monthly salaries. And it had regard to food prices, it had regard to transport, it had regard to rent, and it had regard to mm-hmm. entertainment. So it took a much more holistic point of view.
I think after we had a report out that child poverty in Ireland has skyrocketed.
And that's why the Taoiseach addressed that at the National Dialogue earlier this week. I mean, it's, you know, three priorities: housing, child poverty and disability. And this is going to be reflected in the budget. So,
Claire, the report that Barry's referring to, I think, said that €152 a week was enough to cover your costs. And it had the average wage at €52,000 per year. There's an awful lot of people who are on way below that salary. And the issue around wage pressure is because of the cost of housing. So housing feeds into the cost of living in Ireland, unlike in other countries where they don't have the same level of crisis in housing. I mean, the average rent is €2,540. So if you're, you know, on a low salary, you've nothing left at the end of the day to pay for anything after you pay for your rent.
But I think the idea is you take account of basic expenses, which includes your rent, your food, etc., and you balance it against your average monthly salary. You're absolutely right.
But how can €152 cover the costs?
That's the point. So this is the National Dialogue. Reflected the government's absolute priority in targeting child poverty and making sure that we don't just fire it out of a cannon as has happened in the past, that we look at DESH schools, we look at a possible other level of DESH schools, we see a higher level of children's allowance, you know, potentially
this
doing
the
something.
The second rate that's being discussed at the moment.
Second rate. So
George,
all of this
you want to come back in there?
Yeah, this is a country that has doubled its public expenditure in 10 years. So talk of further subsidies in that context is really unrealistic. The reality is we've...
Subsidies upset you now?
They're not upsetting me. I'm just pointing out they're foolish. So, for example, the one for everyone in the audience subsidies we all got several times...
Energy credits.
...was grossly wasteful, mm-hmm. really inefficient. Use of money, piling up expenditure that could and should have been used more profitably. This shouldn't happen again. It shouldn't be countenanced and it should be recognised.
But is that not why it's important, I think, in the programme for government that there is this review of the energy companies? Because there's a lot of people, I think, around the time of Ukraine were wondering, you know, there was disparity between the prices at Europe that were coming out and prices that we were seeing in bills and concern about, you know, ballooning profits for these energy companies. And I think, you know, as you said, those subsidies were sort of just, you know, putting a plaster over, mm-hmm. I think, the issue rather than getting to the grassroots of what's actually mm-hmm. going on here. Why are we paying such extortionate prices? Yes, there's an issue with pricing in Europe, but we need to look at the Irish energy sector.
What's going on?
And the regulator's powers. I mean, we've been calling for this for years, reform of the regulator, because I heard Charlie Weston earlier even saying that in Ireland we don't prioritise consumer protection, and our regulator is a testament to that, because in other countries the regulator has access to the hedging practices of energy companies, so they're not getting to see the full books, but they are getting the energy companies to justify those costs when they're basically telling us they're banking in forecasting for 6 months gas prices ahead, but we just have to trust them on their word. Other member states allow their regulator to have oversight of the hedging practice. We can also reform the PSO levy so that that's less regressive than it is, because currently it's a flat rate regardless of your income, regardless of your energy use, and then you also have reform of the transmission charges as well, which can be reversed from large energy users would subsidise small businesses and households, which is the case in the north. So there's lots of areas that we can do that we don't have to wait for the EU. Mm-hmm. I agree we need to absolutely decouple the price of gas and our renewable energy, but there are things that are in the power of the government today that they could be doing. They could give the regulator those powers. They can also...
So then you wouldn't be in a position where demands are being made for an energy credit, because you'd have dealt with the root cause of
the
problem.
Well, you can try at least to bring down the cost of electricity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you will need an energy credit this year without a doubt, but I think you have to reform the energy sector. I mean, again, in Britain, we have the issue we've always talked
Gerard
about...
Gerard Allen's going to fall off his chair now if anyone says this energy credit's going to happen again.
It's really bad policy.
But we all heard about the issue of insurance companies punishing people who are loyal customers, and there was outrage over that.
Well,
and calls to ban it.
That happens in energy companies, from there to an energy subsidy. I agree all the suggestions you are making about better regulation.
But that's not going to happen before Christmas.
I accept that, but we've had these subsidies on and off for years, and to say that, because we can't get it together to regulate better, we should subsidise onwards in a country where we've doubled the budget in 10 years, where we have a major infrastructure deficit, we're about to review our national development plan, we're about to make major decisions about what actual priorities are, as distinct from a one for everyone in the audience culture that has characterised our politics in government and opposition for years to the detriment of the country and its competitiveness and the prices we have to pay both in monetary terms for goods and in terms of opportunity cost, because things are not spent well and prudently.
But unfortunately we brought in the energy credits because we were living in a cost of living crisis, and there seems to be some sort of narrative now that we're no longer living in that cost of living crisis. That is not the lived reality for plenty of people that are probably listening in today that are living paycheck to paycheck and literally are counting down the days until their salary is put back into their bank account.
Do you accept that, Barry, that the government's out of step on this?
Well, I'm not sure the out of step is fair to say, because, say the discussion that was taking place earlier this week really focused on this issue and a recognition that, as Gerry said, we can't be throwing it out of a cannon anymore. We have to really target in circumstances where, with the war that's going on, with the geopolitical upheaval, with the tariff threat that's in the background, we'll have to be prudent coming into the budget, and we'll have to make sure that all these measures are targeted. I just think on the energy issue, I'm nervous about conveying the idea that there's an easy way to reduce energy prices, because, if you look at the infrastructure deficits across the country, the need for investment in grids, in interconnectors, in ports, in wind farms themselves, both offshore and onshore, all of these investments are going to add to energy prices, electricity in the short term.
But the way
that is the reality.
For 13 years, households and businesses subsidised large energy users through the transmission cost up to a value of €650 million. That can be reversed in that you ask large energy users to subsidise a little bit more towards the energy infrastructure, especially given that we're seeing that all the capacity on the energy grid is being actually taken up by these large energy users and are preventing houses from being built. So they should at least be contributing more to the cost.
And I just want to move into this area. We had the Taoiseach here yesterday, Simon Harris, and he said that housing has plateaued. Gerard, I might start with you on this. The central bank then revised down the number of houses that it expects to be built, not just this year, but in 2026 and in 2027 as well. We're not going to reach the targets where we need to be. The government says we are going to get to 300,000. It just seems to be, and I'm sure our listeners would agree with this, an intractable problem, Gerard, one that the government is not grappling with successfully yet.
Correct. but it's not intractable in the sense that, unlike some of the issues, I would have far more hope if we got it together to do better on housing sooner than we might be able to do better on energy sooner. Because actually housing, and I don't mean to be trite, I think it is a simpler issue than energy. But we're not getting it together. We tripled, I think, spending on housing in 3 years. There's more social housing being built than ever, but we're not going forwards. I completely accept that. Mm-hmm. And the ingredient parts that have to lock together, better and more electricity grid, better and more water and sewage, better and more major public transport projects to bring land into effective use. They are not being pushed together remotely as fastly or as effectively as they could and should. And that is an issue for government. If you compare with health, if you're the Minister for Health, most of the issues you're concerned with, and possibly most of the solutions you might wish to apply, are within your remit. If you're the Minister for Housing, far fewer of the things you would want to or wish to do are within your direct remit. The whole of government effectiveness is much more important on housing than on health or maybe on energy. And that whole of government effectiveness that really involves the Taoiseach, by the way, who you were speaking with yesterday, and the Taoiseach, is not there in force as consistently or effectively as it should be.
But they've told us so many times that this is priority number
one. It's not
one.
What they say, it's what they do.
So mm-hmm. So the Housing Activation Office that is, you know, troubled in its birth, it brings together all of this whole of government approach. It brings together regulators, it brings together local authorities, government agencies, and the whole idea is to try.
They've made a mess of that now.
Well, look, there's no point in me hiding the fact that that was messy at the very beginning. However, it's there now. It has a very significant budget for the next 5 years. On top of that, you had Sean O'Driscoll here.
That's right, chair of the ESRI, but speaking in a private capacity, and he's on the infrastructure.
Yeah, so the infrastructure is about bringing together all of these. Now, I think there's a massive political opportunity for the government. It, you know, the narrative out there is the government just kind of stuttering, hasn't really found its stride since it was set up. And, you know,
is that fair?
Look, I feel in this
reason
area.
The reason I say that to you is I think most people are confused about those changes to the rent pressure zones and the changes for landlords and for tenants.
These are communications issues. The substance
really?
Of this, yeah. So you know, the mess around the czar, whatever, whoever's going to be appointed, it doesn't take away from the substance of the Housing Activation Office and what it's there to do. Mm. The infrastructure task force is there to make a report, which we'll do in the next couple of weeks. It'll have 40 or 50 recommendations.
But on the rent pressure zones,
yes.
The outcome of that eventually, we're told, is going to be more supply. But more supply of what? Properties to let. And in the meantime, and you know, government reps have said this to us, rents are going to go up. So that's not a communication problem. That's structural.
But the balance has to be struck. On the one hand, you have very strong constitutional property right powers, but the landlords are possessed. You have to incentivize landlords not only to come in, but also not to go out of the market, while at the same time trying to provide security of tenure.
Why focus our energy on attracting people in who are going to build properties to rent when people want to buy homes?
But we have to be honest about these issues, Claire. It's like I said about the energy issues earlier on. If we have a huge amount of infrastructure deficit that we need to address, and in order to attract not only public investment but private sector investment, there's going to have to be a lot of capital outlay.
Come in there, go ahead.
I don't know where to start, to be honest. There's so much to start with, because one, the Housing Activation Unit won't have the emergency statutory powers that the Housing Commission report calls for it to have. So that's one, that they've produced something from the Housing Commission but haven't done that.
But
right,
if we went down the legislative route, we'd be here for another two or three years. That's the reality.
With the rent pressure zones, it's not bad communication when the Minister's office briefs journalists in one way and then has to bring in emergency legislation days later when the opposition pointed out.
Well, they said that
out.
Was always the plan.
But that's not what they told all the journalists who attended the briefing. So what we need to see, like, I think that this idea that, you know, attracting in these large investors, what about people in rural Ireland who want to have a roof over their head? They're not going to be in these large investor apartments. So what we need is to get people out of the private rental sector who don't want to be in the private rental sector, which is a large proportion of private renters. They're either in there as HAP tenants, RAS tenants, who want to get onto into a social housing where they have security tenure for life. That subsidised rent is costing us €1 billion a year. You also then have the renters who are in there, the couples, the individuals who want to buy a home home and have a roof over their head. And then you have pensioners who are in the private sector who are looking, kind of going, I have a modest pension. I'm not going to be eligible for a social house in the future, and I'm not going to be able to afford the private rents. And all of those people are now facing rent increases, but not seeing the focus on building more social housing, more affordable housing to purchase, and more affordable rent. That's what people want. Yeah, it's not just about encouraging investors to come in.
There's a glaring misstep here in terms of government messaging when they're talking about the rule change that they brought in with the rent pressure zones, because the message is that this is an extension nationwide, more renters are protected. Yes, that's true in the short term, but in reality, this is a gradual phasing out of rent caps, because most people only stay in tenancies, I think, on average about 3 years. So if that, when that person leaves, that rent is reset upwards. They're not going to reset downwards. So the rent pressure zones over a series of 5 years will eventually be phased out nationwide, not in place. Now, there will be the rent cap there for if you're in a tenancy
for 6 years.
Simon Harris,
when I said that to him yesterday, he said he hopes that we're going to move to a time where tenancies will extend to the 6 year period and you will be protected in your rent pressure zone because of the new rule.
But that's still quite a high rent, and after 6 years, they're still going to be allowed to increase it upwards. But the issue that I see here is the other message from the government is they're all about home ownership. That's what they're all about. They want people, first-time buyers, to get on the ladder. This doesn't tie with that, because if you're going to increase someone's rent over a series of the 5 years or whatever of this government,
reduces your capacity to buy.
Exactly. And there's no way, like if you're talking about, I think the rent, average rent there over nearly two and a half grand, you know, you're talking about nearly, what, two-thirds of someone's wage is going out on accommodation. Like there's little or no room for someone to actually save for a deposit there. That ties back into the subsidies that Jared was talking about, which are, some people are saying, are inflating the house prices. Mm. Unless there's some big idea here in the July Housing for All reset plan, I can't see how they're actually going to get people out of rented accommodation.
I think it's worth making the point that, that this is a Europe-wide problem. I know we tend to think that it's, you know, a solely Irish situation. I've been dealing with Housing Europe, who reported this week that building permits are down 32% across the European Union. And for the first time, we now have a European housing commissioner in our in the European Parliament. We have a housing committee. There's a recognition that we're going to have a affordable housing plan coming out of the European Union.
What's that going to do for us?
Well, I think what it'll do is, first of all, identify a single European fund for housing. Ireland has traditionally not done very well in terms of drawing down funding from the European Investment Bank, from the European Regional Development
Fund. I don't think
money's
our issue here, though, is it?
No, access to finance is a big problem. It is most certainly a big problem.
For private developers, amount of money the state is spending.
Yeah, but the state, like 50% of housing is provided by the state, is social and affordable housing right now. That's out of balance. Mm-hmm. We have to get more private sector investment, and that is about access to capital. That's why I came up with this idea of making sure we use some of the savings that are available in Ireland on the same model as they have in France, which has generated a massive amount of investment in social and affordable housing. We need some innovative approaches
to how
we... It's
around 150 billion, is it, that is sitting there that could be used?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, all right, listen, I want to move on to something else. Jared, Barry's beside you there, and he's ruled himself out now of running for President of Ireland. Did he make the right decision?
Well, unless he was making room for Lynn Boylan.
Well, he might
I'm hearing this, Lynn, yes?
Well, I thought I could rule myself out so I'd get a full page in the Indo as well, like Barry.
Yeah. Well, Lynn was teasing me earlier on, saying I ruled myself out of something I wasn't asked to do.
I think Barry would have made a fine president, and I regret that he's not available just to put his name on the ballot paper. People are running away from this.
Why?
Because it was a horrible experience for so many. It was a very public experience. There's an awful lot of money involved. People who really good candidates with good CVs didn't make the minimum threshold to get state funding. They were left with a lot of debt afterwards. If you don't have a big party behind you, you'd want to be very wary or very rich. And if you do have a big party behind you, no big party is as big or as important in a presidential election as it was historically, even in recent history. Mm-hmm. The party brands are worth less. People are looking for something different in a president. That doesn't mean a party candidate couldn't win. I'm not saying that, but traditional loyalties matter less. Overall, they matter less in a presidential election. The cost, the ferocity, we're going to have the shortest campaign and the shortest list of candidates in years. And I think, you know, I'm thinking when Tom O'Higgins ran against Erskine Childers, we're going to have a ballot paper about as short as that, I suspect. Mm.
It'll be interesting to see who emerges in the coming weeks. But Micheál Martin says he's taking soundings now in Fianna Fáil, so your party hasn't ruled out finding somebody to go.
Yeah, I think Fianna Fáil will. I've heard that Fine Gael are running a nomination process the next couple of weeks, and then we'll have a vote in September. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happens within Fianna Fáil as well. So we'll see what happens.
Right. I mean, what does it say to you, Christina, that we are at this stage and we don't really have anybody apart from Conor McGregor and Peter Casey who've said they're interested in running for this job? I mean, it's more than a job.
Yeah, I think it very much means that the last, as you said, presidential election campaign was an absolute bloodbath, and people are wary about going in early on this. If you have silly season in the media, you know, pages of newspaper columns need to be filled, plenty of time to dig around in someone's background and for all the skeletons to come out of the closet. So I think the government parties in particular are eager to have sort of a short run into this. I was speaking to Harris in an interview some months ago, and he was saying that he thought it might be a good idea for Fine Gael to have a competition within the party, that you know, perhaps a hustings type thing, or, you know, debate within the party would be healthy for Fine Gael.
Sean Kelly and Marie McGuinness, it looks like, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, what that allows a nomination process to, in fact, stall the eventual nomination, provided there's more than one candidate, which I predict there will be, whether the second person wants to be on that list or not. Because by having more than one candidate, you can then postpone till September.
Right.
And the parties really want the shortest possible.
And for you, if it's not you, Lynn, from Sinn Féin.
It's not me.
Are you sure?
100% sure.
We're for you.
I would not put myself through that campaign.
Is Sinn Féin going to put someone forward? Have you made that decision yet?
Very similar to Fianna Fáil. They're getting soundings and there's a consultation process with the membership.
There's no one jumping up and down then either who wants it, right?
Well, I think you have to accept that President Michael T. Higgins is a very, very hard act to follow. He's an incredibly popular president. I think he's done an exceptional job as president and sort of been that figurehead for the country. You know, he's done us proud. So it is big shoes to fill. But I also think that the nature of these campaigns are so brutal and so focused on an individual, and this was an individual's family, extended family, that, you know, anybody who's even considering it is going to have to go and consult with their family as well as just their own personal ambitions. But I think it's similar. It is a consultation process within the party.
OK, I have got to take a break and I better do that now. Let's do that.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.